just turn it on, and this is April the 13th, 2011, with Orin Lee Peters. And your official birthday to turn 90 is the 23rd, is that right? Or what?
No, the 16th.
The 16th, okay, the day after tax day.
Right.
So, 90 years.
The 16th of April, 1921.
Wow. So what is your early? What's your earliest memory? What can you remember from your childhood that you would say is going back? I mean, you remember before school, or do you remember early days of school?
Well, yes, I remember about when I was a kid. I lived on 2nd Street. That's where I was born. Of course, back when I was a kid. What such thing in hospitals?
Did was a midwife the one that helped your mom, or did the doctor come to the house?
Doctor came to the house. Doctors made you send for the doctor, and he'd come with his little black bag. And,
make the house call.
And it was a house call.
That's right. Now, how many did you have, brothers and sisters?
Yes. I have three sisters and three brothers.
And where were you in the birth order?
Right in the middle.
Right in the middle?
Yeah.
Now,
I had three brothers older and one sister, and one brother and three sisters younger.
Okay. Now, your parents came to Oklahoma at what time?
My mother came in 1889. My great-grandfather and my grandfather and his brother and his sister all made the run of 1889.
They did.
And, of course, my mother and her three brothers came with my grandmother.
Where did they come from? What part of the country were they from?
They came from Kansas. And my grandfather and his dad, brother and sister were just northeast and claimed their land with the old man had his 160. Across the road from him was Will, and down on the other corner was my grandfather John.
All and adjacent then, together in the same.
All, and then up in the opposite corner was my mother's aunt Mary, and she married her boyfriend right next door to her, and so she had to give up her land. They couldn't both claim. No, not
land.
If they got married. So
They
got married, and she gave up hers.
Okay. Now, had all of them been farmers before?
No. My grandfather was a carpenter. He hated farming, and
but that was the rule, wasn't it? That you had to farm that land.
It had to be productive.
Okay. Which was defined as what? How productive for crops, or could you raise cattle and call it productive?
Whatever. You could. Raise gardens, or but you had to live there.
Right. You had to occupy it, and it had to be productive.
Right. And you had to build a structure. Didn't say what kind. It could be a cave. Could be a. In this case, it was a barn, and that's what most of them did because
it was functional.
Right. And then you could build on eventually, but
right.
And you had 5 years to do it.
Any of those structures still standing?
on the only piece that's left, there's nothing, really.
Now, how did your family come to be city dwellers if you all had been out originally?
My grandfather, like I say, hated farming. So he moved up and started building, doing carpenter work in Edmond. And, of course, my mother, being a child, was with him. My mother married my dad that was working on the railroad. He had his fan of mules, and a teenager. His dad was working on the railroad. They were living in a boxcar on the siding up at Seward.
Wow.
And this was 1902 that he came through, and they were working the railroad, pulling dirt. My dad had a span of mules and worked a slip.
Now, when you say a span of mules and a slip, I don't know what those are. I bet a bunch of people listening may not know. So a span, would that be two mules?
That's two mules.
Okay.
You have a mule or you have a span.
And a slip is a like a trailer, like a wagon?
Oh, no. No, it's I tell people it's an oversized teaspoon. That had there was two different types. One of them had a single bar, but most of them it was about that wide and about that deep, and had two handles on it. If you were to take an old-fashioned wheel bar and take the front of it out, you would have a slip and mules that you lift it up, it would fill with dirt, you'd push it down, go to where you want to dump it, and flip it up in the air and come back around and do the same thing. And so
when you needed dirt moved to a location, you would hire people that had a slip, and they would move the dirt
right
where you needed it.
And it was horses and mules, and that was. And if you look down the railroad track, and you'll see that all of that, it's higher. All of that dirt was pulled in there.
Right. So would your dad have worked on this railroad track that's right here?
Yes. And, of course, then after they built the tracks, they'd come back, and pull more dirt up because it did wash away.
Maintenance.
Yeah. And he married my mother, and, of course, he had to move out of the car.
Yeah, right.
And they moved into a tent. And
where was that? Was that here in Edmond? Back in Seward?
In Seward.
Where is Seward? It's not on the interstate now, and I don't know that I've been there. Is it? What's it close to?
If you get on the boulevard and just go straight north,
okay,
you'll come to a little town of Seward.
Still there?
Still there. Probably there may still be a half a dozen buildings there and the cemetery.
So was it a tent city then that they were?
Oh no,
they had there?
No, they just pitched a tent fairly close to the tracks because they were working. Was responsible for a section of the railroad that they had to maintain.
Now, did your dad come from Kansas also?
He came from Kansas.
Do you know what part of Kansas? Either your mom's side or your dad's side came from?
Lenape, Kansas.
Okay.
And
but that wasn't part, it was at the run. The run was what drawed for them to come?
Just my mother. Okay. With her dad.
It was the railroad then that brought your
yes.
dad to the state?
And probably you need to know about why Edmund is here.
Right. Now, I remember in the historical, they talked about Summit and that this was the highest point.
Highest point on the railroad.
Between what points?
Canadian and the Cimarron.
Oh, good.
And go to First Street, stand on the railroad tracks, look four directions, and you're looking downhill.
That's the high spot right there.
And that's the high spot.
And that's why that was First Street, and that was the middle of town.
Second Street was, First Street is the middle of town, but there was more activity on Second Street because that was closest to the river, to the depot. And so, see, this was unassigned lands, and you know the history of
it. A little bit, but for people who may, unassigned meant in the Native Americans, the Indians, had not been given them, and they weren't officially owned
it
by
was,
anybody, right?
Right. It was. It was still Indian territory.
But it wasn't designated.
It wasn't designated. It was, but after the shuffling and so on, here's this piece of property that was not part of a tribe.
Now, when you say it was, what do you mean? At some time it had been?
Well, when they... I don't remember the tribe that had that particular part, but and the Indians established their own nations with their own government,
right.
And those nations actually still exist.
I didn't really know this until moving to Oklahoma that they are sovereign nations, and there's like 36 of them or something. I think.
And right. They're still there. Most of their courthouses have been turned into museums, and it's there. And they that's why you see all of the casinos.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's tribal land. Yeah.
It's tribal land, and they.
So your parents were here at the beginning of Edmund, and your dad came to work for the railroad, and
married my mother.
Were they? When did they move from Seward? And come here.
They moved moved from Seward to Second.
Seward, like Seward, Seward.
Yes.
Okay.
To Second Street. Although the house faced the west, which was Fritz, you would think it would have a Fritz number.
Yeah.
But it was 229 West 2nd Street.
Okay.
And was at the time that the house was built. It was one of the craft homes.
What is a craft home?
You're in a craft home. That's the back door right there.
That this was a standard model for this part of Oklahoma?
Yeah. And I'll show you some of them in just a second if we need to go outside.
Sure.
But they came Back to what I was telling you, this was the unassigned land.
Right.
This is what they ran for. Nobody lined up on the state line of what is now Oklahoma and charge in.
That's all fiction.
Because they came as far as the unassigned lands, and then they ran for the property.
Do you happen to know where that was? I mean, where did they actually... They did shoot a gun, and they went off at the gun shop, right? Is that...
Right.
That part's accurate.
A lot of people just got on the train and came through, and when they saw something, they'd jump off and go out and claim their land. If you notice, I never talk about staking because nobody staked a claim.
So, because that's part of what the kids do in third grade or whatever.
Third grade.
And so there's some fiction in what they were reenacting.
Right. And the reason the stakes are already here. See, all of the Oklahoma was surveyed into sections, and you have a section is 1 mile square.
And that's why we've got these roads that are the main section lines, like 122nd,
right.
And Hefner and Ritten, and those.
Everything is on the square. When you came to Oklahoma, you got into Oklahoma. Everything runs north and south, east and west.
And when you got a claim, did you get a quarter of a section?
You got a quarter of a section, 160 acres. So, but the railroad was already here because you couldn't get from Kansas to Texas without getting permission to go through Indian territory, and the Indians very seldom gave it. So that meant that you were going around to get to Texas.
Around Oklahoma?
Around Oklahoma.
Wow.
You couldn't go through. So there was quite an upcry about, you know, so Santa Fe got permission to survey and build a railroad through from Kansas to Texas. And they told them, while you're surveying, says you've got to find water. Steam engines back then could only go about 25 miles without having to have fresh water. You've got Guthrie, close to a river. Oklahoma City, river. That's more than 25 miles. So the surveyors were looking for water as they went through, and they found Spring Creek. Spring Creek is at Littler and Fourth. And that park where the museum is, that's the head of Spring Creek. And that's how it got its name. There was a spring there. They said, water, it's close. This will be a watering hole. So they went back to where the railroad tracks was and dug a well. And that's what it's a good story. They brought in Steen and his wife and son. And Steen was in charge of seeing if the well was dug. And the first thing they built was a pump house. And that's where the Steens lived while And when you think about the size of that well, all by hand, picks, shovels, and buckets. 100 carloads of rock to rock it up on the inside.
And carload being a train car?
What?
A train car of rock? Or when you say carload?
Train carloads of rock.
Wow.
So, so they had a station here, and they called it Station 102 because it was between 101 and 102 miles from where the track started. And had to give it a name, so they gave it the name of Summit because it's the highest point on the railroad. But very few people ever called it Summit because they referred to it as Edmonds Station. And there was a freight. The freight man here that worked out of the station was named Edmund Burdick. And so everyone said, if you want something done, just go down to Edmund Station. He'll take care of it. So Santa Fe thought, well, you know, we think a lot of old Edmund, too. He's a good person. If everyone's going to call it that, we'll just name it that. So they officially named it Edmund. And that's how it got its name.
Now, is that well over at Littler and Second or Fourth also? Or where was the well itself that they dug?
The north side of the underpass is right through the well.
Like where the Edmund Sun is today? I mean, or it would be west of... You said the underpass where the train goes over now?
Yes.
Because they had to build it right by the track. So
right.
That they could...
And it was on the west side of the track.
Yeah, okay, on the west side.
Okay. When they... So here they had a station in the unassigned lands. And they had people here maintaining the station, had the coal bin, the big coal bin that was, that would have been around 5th Street is where they would pull in to get coal. And you've seen the statue that they have up here of Kentucky Daisy.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good story about Kentucky Daisy, how she rode the cow catcher up and jumped off, ran out, staked a claim, fired a pistol in the air, ran back and caught the end of the train to go to Guthrie
to file it.
And Kurt Munson, I don't know, do you know Kurt? Kurt Munson is the one that is responsible for it. And while he was raising money, I told him, I said, Kurt, that's a good story, and I tell it. But I said, you know, when the train got to Edmond, it stopped, they filled it with water, backed it up, put coal in it, and while they were doing this, Mrs. Steen was feeding the crew. So that was no big feat because you could go quite a ways and get back to the train with no problem. And he says, don't tell anybody that. I'm having trouble getting because the trains all stopped here. Okay, with that in mind and with the word that they're going to open up the unassigned lands, Santa Fe knew that with every train stopping here, they needed to lay out a town. So they had their surveyors on the tracks, which is legal. It was their land, but they couldn't get off of it. But I think they gave them 10 minutes after the run started. Then they could survey the town.
Huh.
They were in such a hurry to survey the town that they didn't establish a baseline. They had one. The tracks. The tracks run at an angle. So the original town of Edmond
was crooked.
Runs at an angle. I said the edge was out here. Did you notice there's a little jog there and straightens up? That's because they surveyed the town off of the tracks.
Now, would they have had Indian tribes around if they had been
Indians weren't here. This was unassigned.
Was it federal property then?
This is federal property. So, the Indians were here crossing and all, but they didn't leave here. That wasn't.
Do you remember ever seeing Indians when you were young or ever having
any
of your actions?
Oh, yes.
What do you remember about? What did they look like? What tribe were they? Do you remember any? That a normal thing to see or unusual to see?
They didn't come to town often because everything they had, were in their areas where they had established their nation.
They were self-sufficient.
Well, sure. Area. Yeah. And had people going to Indian nations to buy and to get things because they were well established. And so that's how Edmond is where it is because of Spring Creek.
Yeah. Now, in the 1920s, automobiles had been around for a while. Did anybody... You remember anybody having horses when you were growing up and using horses to work, or was everything mechanized?
Oh, no. My Uncle Dennis and Uncle Otis, that's Mom's brothers, they still lived out on their claims, and that's all they had was horses. They didn't have any mechanized to work their land, their crops.
How was their land productive? What did they plant, or what did they do?
They had cows, and Uncle Dennis had a few horses and mules, they raised crops. They had uh, Uncle Otis had grape vineyards. He had planted corn, peanuts. They had spots of grain, mostly just enough to feed the cattle. And so when my grandma and grandpa came to town, they had their building, they had their home, and then back on the corner had a barn, and had chickens and cows. And after my grandfather died, she continued, and I stayed with her. And started in sixth grade, and I stayed 4 years. And
living with her and helping take care of things?
Yeah. And she was really independent. I wasn't taking care of her as much as she is taking care of me, because I'd be out, gathered eggs, and did a few chores. But all the housework, the cooking, everything, she did everything in the house. And I would deliver eggs to most of her eggs went to the Wide Awake Cafe, because after she managed to sell them her first eggs, why she had Buff Orpington chickens, and they laid big eggs.
What kind of chicken?
Buff Orpingtons.
Okay.
She didn't like Leghorns at all. They were too small, didn't lay big eggs, and she wanted the big eggs. So.
What do you remember about holidays? Like, is it 4th of July? You have early memories of what the, or Christmas time? What's your earliest holiday memories growing up?
Well, of course, with older brothers and a sister, from ever since I was small, everyone had Christmas at our house. And when my brother got married, and they'd always come back, and as we grew up, around Christmas time, that's when you always went to my folks. That was so ours was, of course. See, I lived through the Dust Bowl. We were poor and I didn't know it. If when the things that you could buy with pennies, 2 cents a loaf for bread, shows 5 cents.
For what?
For the theater, the show.
The shows, 5 cents.
5 cents.
And where was that theater?
It was the Gym Theater, and you know where they're building the the restaurant in town.
Here on this side of Second Street, or
yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. Right next door was the Gym Theater. McCall's has it now. But that was the Gym Theater. the old theater on the corner up here, that was an open-air theater. And the screen was next to the sidewalk. And you entered from the alley, and it was sloped down and was open.
Would people sneak in to try to get the show?
Oh, well, that was... Everyone, all the kids always tried to sneak into everything. but old man Spearman had the theater and his wife, and when they built the new theater on the corner, why... people, he would hire anyone that wanted to come and lay up rock. And next time you pass by it, if you'll just look at the wall, you'll see where they stopped building. And I think it might have trying to think. I really don't remember how many, you might say, stabs at it it took, but you can see where they quit laying.
Mm-hmm.
And he would tell people, said, "We're out of money, so you're going to have to get people to go come to the show." And said, "When you get more money, why, we'll go back to work." And so it shows on the wall where they stop building. But anyway, that was, they built it, and that was a little later, because during sandstorms, that was a terrible time, because never really saw the sun. Just sand in the air. And the houses were not built as well as they're built now. And so there was just a settling of sand in the house. And of course, if you started sweeping it up, that's why it would circulated in the house some more, you know. It was...
what grade were you in, or what age you...
I was... that was while I was in first through the fourth, somewhere in there.
Were you... Yeah. Where was your school? You weren't going to school up here?
No, we had West Side School.
West Side School.
Well, it was, by the time I went to school, it was Lowell School. When it was originally built, that and Kingsley were the two schools. And they were two-story. And there was, two rooms upstairs, and there was four rooms downstairs. And by the time I went to school, the school had been condemned, and they redid it. And for my first 2 years, we had outside toilets.
And school.
And well.
Or everywhere. I mean, everyone had outhouses.
Well, yeah. These houses, like I said, I'll show you the houses. But this house was a four-room house. One room, two rooms, three rooms, four rooms. Four rooms house. No running water. No toilet. The well and the toilet were outside. You had my grandmother had a cellar with a small, what they called a smokehouse, over the cellar. This one, the cellar is just outside the door, and you stepped out on a concrete slab, which was the top of the cellar, and you enter it from over here to go down into it.
So, like Black Sunday, when they talk about the big storm, were there particular times in the Dust Bowl that you remember being intensely bad, and then other times where it was just the sky was just,
yeah.
Was the sky black, red, orange? What did it look like?
It was a had a reddish tint because that's the sand around here. And when the sun lit up, why, of course, the dirt and sand would settle a little bit. When wind began to blow, my mom would take and wet a sheet to put on the windows and all on the north or the south, depending on which direction the wind was blowing. So,
and was that, did that go on for months or years, or how long you would use? And did people talk about that in biblical terms? Did they think God had cursed the land, or what did people think about and say about the dust at that time? They just knew the farmers had plowed up too much land, or what did they say?
They just, it's just dust, and we were in the city. But you go north and west of here. The sand blew up. It had a pretty steady fence. It'd start piling up, just like snow would. And you'll see pictures of it where here's these big mounds of sand.
And so that wasn't just out in the panhandle, and that was not far from here.
Right. And the thing, when Sunday I was, went to church up in Stillwater, and the preacher's daughter, who is not ordained yet, but is going to be a teacher, gave a sermon, and in her sermon, before, as she started, she said that she was from Texas, but she is now in Oklahoma. Said, I am a Okie. After the sermon was over, I reminded her that the Okies were the ones that left the state of Oklahoma and went to California, and they got the name Okie. And if you live in Oklahoma, you're either a cowboy or a Sooner.
Well, speaking of that, did any of your family leave during the Dust Bowl, or
no.
Did everybody stay?
No, everybody stayed.
Do you remember anybody talking about leaving? Did they think about
no.
that?
No. They had their land built in. My father at that time was grading roads. He was working for the county. he graded roads. Started with horses, horse-drawn. Maintenance graders, they call them. And he drove the first Caterpillar tractor that the county had to grade roads. So he worked for the county, and it would have been around 1935-36. he voted for his boss, who was beaten in the election, and the new county commissioner that came in fired everybody that didn't vote for him. So to keep the family alive, he cut wood. Of course, he knew everyone in this part of the county, and so he would go help them clean their land for the wood.
To clear it.
And he would clear. He would clear land. Had an old Ford truck that would slip out of gear, and so when you drove, why, of course, you'd shift it. When you got into high, had a 4-inch board that had a notch cut in it, and you'd put the notch on the shift, and of course the other on the dash to hold it in place, and you'd drive.
It wouldn't slip out of gear then, huh?
It wouldn't slip out of gear. But
did you learn to drive on that truck?
No. only my two bigger older brothers got to do that, but he would take the the logs, throw it on the truck, bring it in, and unload it every day after. Then on the weekend, when we were out of school, why, he'd hook up the buzz saw, and he'd cut the wood up into 16-inch pieces and rick it up. And he sold wood for 25 cents a rick.
Oh, my gosh.
And
now, why do everyone say Rick here instead of Cord?
Because a Rick is one half a cord. A cord is a 4x4x4. And a Rick is 16x4x4. And so that's how.
Did you? Did your dad ever go back to grading roads for the county? Or did
yes, he did. He he went back, and then he retired from the county, and because of his skill, the city hired him to maintain the streets in town. Because everything was gravel. There was the Broadway was concrete and brick. The road coming in was with brick, and everything going east all the way to Guthrie was a brick highway. And the concrete road from the center of town to Fritz to 3rd Street was paved.
When was the first paved road put in it, do you think?
I don't know, because I don't remember anything except our road in front of our house was paved. And
but you were saying 2nd Street was kind of a main street too, right? I mean, it was
not all the way through. you coming down 2nd Street before you got to the railroad track, which was Santa Fe land, there was big pillars up there. Because the depot set on 2nd Street. And then you get around on the other side, why, you take 2nd Street on down, so 2nd Street didn't go all the way down. And I was a kid when they paved 3rd Street from Broadway down to Fritz, and then it was gravel from there on out, and Highway 66 and 77 came from the State Capitol building into Edmond, out to the Bradbury corner or the 3 mile corner. 77 went north and 66 went on up through Tulsa.
So the Bradbury corner on the other side of I-35, or how far down is it?
Bradbury corner was on before you get to. No, I-35, you're Fredericksburg corner would be on the corner of 2nd and I-35.
Okay. So how about you in school? What did you do in school? And somewhere along the line, UCO got built, right, when you were growing up? Or was that...
Was
it already there?
It was built. And my grandfather is the one that told him how much rock it would take to build the building. And he was a rock mason. And, of course, I didn't know until years later that he was the one that was the contractor for the building of it.
And then we're talking about Old North?
Old North Tower.
Because that is the first building?
That's the first building. And they played basketball in the on the top floor of the building. I went to the fourth grade up at Central. And
call from Ed.
When you say Central, are you talking about not Central Middle School now? Or is that what you're talking about, across from our church?
No. Central State Teachers College.
Oh, it's Central State. Okay.
Central State.
You went to fourth grade there?
I went to fourth grade there.
How did that happen?
Because they had a demonstration school.
Oh.
you might as well know that... I'm dyslexic. I didn't know it, but but I was the dummy in school, and I made it through the third grade, memorizing pictures. When we were learning to read, we had our readers, and you'd get in a circle, and then you'd read paragraphs and just go around, and had pictures, and when they would read, I made out some of the words before they got turned around, and but I'd see the picture and I would remember what someone had read. I'd see that picture and I'd just go ahead and read it like I knew what I was doing. And so when I entered the fourth grade, my mother got real disgusted with the teacher. They were talking about I wasn't doing getting my work, doing my math real well, and but I couldn't read, and so she sent me up to enroll me into the demonstration school.
How did that go?
Oh, went real well, but I said I'm trouble reading.
I was going to say, did they know about dyslexia at that time?
No, they didn't know what I was seeing on a page, I really didn't know about dyslexia till I had two kids that had it. So they know what to do now to help kids. And in fact, my daughter is a reverend and does real well. And my youngest son is a retired chemical engineer that ran BMW's nuclear reprocessing plant. And he's now working for a company. After retiring, they came to him, and a French company has bought up all the nuclear plants in the United States. And they came to him and said, hey, we're having trouble. We've got, we don't know what we've got out here. We've got engineers and so on, but we need help. They talked him into, he's independent now. Oh gosh. He takes off when he wants to. But anyway, his son is working with them, and he told me he's coming to my birthday, and said that Ryan can't go because they have an outage in is it Carolina? Mm-hmm. I think it's Carolina. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they have an outage. He said that he'll be there a while and won't be coming. Mm-hmm. So,
well, what was your pathway to the Army? Because I know you ended up joining the Army and you were in World War II. School-wise, what age were you, and how did that come to happen?
Well, I was in the Boy Scouts. Had two brothers in the National Guard. And when I was going to junior high, up where Russell Doherty is now, I would come by the armory, or really it was Mitchell Hall. Mitchell had built a building in downtown Edmond, which was a big hall that he built to rent to the college to play basketball in. Well, they built the basketball court, all swimming pool and all, and so they rented out the hall and made it a skating rink. And they also rented the use of it for the National Guard. And the National Guard had this big room in the north end of it where they had their equipment. Rifles and so on. And I dropped by and watched what was going on and got real interested. Well, they, in the meantime, they built 1937, built the National Guard Armory, which is on Boulevard.
Museum.
Yeah. Which is the museum, right. They built it. Well, in 38, I got going down there and asking about, you know, getting in. I got my Eagle in April of 1940. September the 16th of 1940. I was in the National Guard by this time. I went to summer camp in 1938. I was a member of the National Guard. I wasn't, but I thought I was. I went to camp, stood muster, and got paid. And
that sounds like you remember if you were getting paid and going through the drill.
Well, the thing was, they were still using the old system that you could be a member of the National Guard and pay someone to take your place to go to camp, go to drill, and you're still there. You're getting your promotions and so on.
But and you're paying somebody else to go for you?
Oh, yeah. During the Civil War, people paid someone else to take their place. Didn't you know this? Oh, yes.
Huh.
So, it wasn't until January of 39, and like I say, this came up later when they were, you know, doing my time of service. And I said, well, I was in 38. I went to camp. They said, you weren't a member until the 9th of January, 1939. Well,
had you been serving for somebody else then, or how did that come to happen?
I was serving for somebody else, but I was getting paid for it.
But you didn't realize it?
No, I didn't. Shoot, I was making drill just...
Oh, wow.
But anyway...
Did you know war was coming at that time?
Oh, no.
Really?
No.
Because Europe in 39 was, I think, when the Blitzkrieg and Poland and stuff. So there was stuff happening in Europe, but you didn't know that we were going to war.
I knew there was a war going on in Europe.
But Americans didn't think that we would inevitably be drawn in at that point. That wasn't...
What's your son think about Iraq and all?
Giving it distant back. Things, you know.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm a kid.
Yeah.
So, September, of course, just started my junior year in high school. And the colonel called me in, and Captain Messina B. Murray, this is the governor's son, he called me in the orderly room and said, little Pete, said, I'm going to discharge you. And I thought I'd done something wrong. And I said, well, what are my brothers? No, he told me. But I asked him why. And he said, well, we're going to be inducted. I didn't know what inducted meant. Didn't mean anything to me. He said, we're going to be inducted, and I'm discharging everybody that's in school. because we're going to go on active duty for 1 year. Well, something else that I didn't know, my brother went home and told my mother that he thought it would be a good idea if I went on active duty for 1 year. He said I'd be bigger and stronger, come back and play football, which I loved, and he can it'll do him some good. He can come home with a little money in his pocket. And she said, well, will you take care of him? Well, yeah, okay. That's how I got to stay in. So on, like I say, September, we're inducted. We all moved down to the armory.
Here in Oklahoma City or the one in Edmond?
In Edmond. That's our...
Because it was built in 37 and that's where...
That
you lived there? You moved there?
We moved there. They brought cots in. And we're in the Army.
Now, why were... Is this just a regular thing the National Guard would do? Why
this is the first time. And they... President Roosevelt called up a few National Guard units. California was one. We were one. I don't know if 36 was called up at that time or not, but anyway, there was just a few National Guard units. And we went to Fort Sill. But we were here, or we were stayed at the Armory for 1 week.
So you had done basic training at Fort Sill?
We haven't. Nope.
Haven't done that yet?
Nope. We're at the Armory.
Okay.
So then they move us, finally. Say it's time moves, so they moved us to, we went by train, by the way.
And about how many people would this have been that were activated in Edmond for the unit?
78.
And your brother, both your older brothers were in there?
Both my brothers. And there were 78 of us. There's two of us left. Barney in Florida and me. But anyway, we were at Fort Sill until November. In November, we moved to Barkley, Texas.
And that would have been in 41, right? So November. No, this is the same year. So September. And then by November, you were in Barkley, Texas.
Right.
What were you doing in that time? Were they having you do drills and march?
We were doing drills. We were doing formations.
Shooting and practicing your marksmanship?
Marksmanship. Going through calisthenics, getting in shape, doing what the Army does. Of course, didn't have all the equipment that you would normally have, and you've read about how they used mortar sections would have pistol pipe that they was a mortar and drop rocks in it as though they were. But anyway, when we went to Camp Barkley, we were there, and this is just outside of Abilene. And while we were going to town, going to the show, and enjoying ourselves, and then December the 7th, I was in the theater, and Emily, and the theater had a big white screen. It was really a board painted white up next to the screen, and they would flash messages up there, and they put that up for the Army, and that if a commander wanted someone, he would tell them, and they would flash the name up, report, and came up, all soldiers report to your units. Well, this was the picture, Sergeant York. And it's real interesting. It's right at interesting part. They had already gone to war. And not a few people left. Came back on, you know, and all soldiers report to your units. And I'm thinking, gosh, can't be that important. And while I'm thinking whether I should go or not, the lights came on. The picture went off. And someone went to the stage and said, "Everyone, back to your units." Because over two-thirds of us was soldiers in the place. So went out, and people, before we got to the bus stop to pick up the bus, why, the word was out that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. And never forget going on the bus, going out, one of the guys said, "Soldier, don't remember the exact word, but something to the effect, so they bombed Pearl Harbor. What in the hell are we going to camp for?" Well, we were in for the duration.
And you had Lose been in September, and this was December.
And this was December the 7th.
So you'd been in the Army for a few months.
Yeah.
And then Pearl Harbor.
Then Pearl Harbor. So, of course, the history, Louisiana maneuvers, big marches.
What are Louisiana maneuvers?
Changed. What?
What are Louisiana maneuvers?
This is the National Guard and the Army, first time that they've ever come.
Really?
Had
a joint activity or a joint mission?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
And we moved to, from there, well, all of this activity now starts in that we're a square division. That's outmoded. We're still part is still using horses. Our parades, the officer of war rode horses in the parade. But we were getting sedans and all, and they triangulized the division from a square to a triangular division, which meant that one of our regiments moved out and went to the Panama Canal, and then eventually to the Pacific. That was the 158.
We had like 158. You divided into three parts then for the triangle?
Three regiments.
Okay.
And each one of us had artillery support from the 105s and the 155s was in support, and so we had to get used to our communications.
Were the 78 of you still together as one group?
Yes, and we were headquarters. We were headquarters company, 179th Infantry.
And you then were put in part of a larger unit based out of Fort Sill, or where?
No. We had a division. Our division was made up of the Oklahoma National Guard, the Colorado National Guard, New Mexico, and Arizona.
Wow.
See, the National Guard was small units. See, we only hit the National Guard in Edmond now, although we don't have a division, the armory services roughly 200 people.
What was the name of your division?
45th Infantry Division. The Thunderbirds.
And that's the one that we have the museum down in Oklahoma City for. Okay. I'm putting the pieces together.
Okay. So we went after we had done that.
Did you go down to Panama? The Panama Canal?
Oh, no.
That was just...
I'm the 179th.
Okay.
There were two brigades, the 89th and the 90th, and we were in the 90th. The 89th brigade had the 158 and the 157th and the 158th. So they took the 158th out, which left the 179th, the 180th, and the 157th. That made up the three. Then we moved to Fort Devens, Massachusetts. And when we moved to Massachusetts, up until this time, all the communications came out of Regimental Headquarters Company, which I was in. And there was intelligence and some of the other units with for a company. We had this small battalion headquarters that just consisted of officers and very few enlisted men. And when you went to the field, then all the support and communications and everything made up the company. And then when you finished, you came back to your unit. Well, when we got to Devens, they said, that doesn't work. We've got to have a battalion headquarters company complete with the communications, the intelligence, the administration, everything. So they said they needed people to fill those positions. So of course, conversation going around, well, what's going to happen if you get over there? And someone told me that I was in the message center of the regimental headquarters, and I said, what position is over there? And they said, well, message center chief. I'm a first third.
What does that mean?
I was first class. I was a first class, third rated specialist.
Now you started private still? Was private Lois, and then you moved up from there?
Yes. I was still private.
Okay.
But I had moved up in pay scales from a private to a private first class, private second class, private third class. I was making as much as a buck sergeant was making. So they said the message center chief job is open. Well, message center chief is staff sergeant. That's three up and one below. So I said, I'll do that. And, of course, my brother came around wanting to know what in the hell I was going to do. And I told him.
I'm
sorry.
I'm making you do lots of talking.
Do you want something to drink?
I'll take a glass of water if you've got. You want to get one?
I was going to be the message center chief. And he wanted to know why. And I said, well, I said, I'm going to be a non-commissioned officer. And he said, well, okay. I reminded him that I was only going to be about 50 yards from in the barracks from where I was there. So we trained there, and
had you been trained in communications? Is that what you had done with this unit?
Oh yes.
So and communications at that time meant what? Was that all radios or?
Radios, wire section, and there was three sections in the communication platoon.
Wire section would lay wire from point
right.
to point.
And that was really, that and runners was most of the way through war. Was commanders talked on the telephone. when we were inducted, we had radios that UCW And they were powered with little square generators like this on a tripod that had a seat on it. Two seats go out and one coming back, and then it had a little deal to sit on. You'd sit there and crank it, and I'd sit there.
Would you do Morse code on them, or is it all?
I never did do Morse code. I went to Morse code school, but I couldn't do it. didn't make sense to me. It just, I know the code, but I couldn't read it. Jack Barber. I tell this about Jack. Jack could use a speed key and put a pressing down one, you know. You push it one way as a dot, you push it back, it's a dash. And he could sit there and we had code, and our coders was four-letter groups. And he could sit there and work that thing, and it was fast, just as fast as he could. He would send a message, carry on a conversation, and drink whiskey all at the same time, and never miss a beat on any of it.
So multitasking is nothing new to
and a lot of these radio operators were that good. But anyway, so it was that. Right after we got to Barclay, we got our first radios. Now, we had walkie-talkies before we had gotten them in. Probably six, seven months before we were inducted. The radio and battery weighed 25 pounds. And on a with a fresh battery, on a good day, almost line of sight, you could get 5 miles. The handheld walkie-talkies, have you seen? They're about that big. Those walkie-talkies, on a good day, line of sight, you could get a mile.
Oh, wow.
So you can see why that wire was important. Mm-hmm. And we had WD-130, they called it. It was wire with rubber and a cloth covering. Two strands, and came on a big drum, and we had half a mile and a mile drums. And so when we strung wire wise,
that's what you use.
That, and the commander, just as soon as he stopped, the wire team was right behind him with clips that they clipped onto that thing so that he could talk. But that gets us off of
Massachusetts. Did they let you become the chief?
I was the chief.
They did?
Did
you become a staff sergeant then?
I became a staff sergeant.
That's a pretty big promotion all at once, isn't it?
It was a big promotion, but not pay grade.
And you're still, are you 17 at this point?
Oh, no. By this point, I'm 18.
Well, if it's 41 and you're born in 21, you're 20? Yeah. You're 20.
Not yet. But anyway, we go from there. Well, while we're there, Patton visits us, watches some of the training, and we paraded and all, and he called the officers to the or had them all in the theater and talked to them and said that he was on his way to North Africa, and they had given him a choice of divisions that were ready to go, and he wanted to command the commander for the morale of his troops, but their discipline is for shit. So right after that, we went up to Pine Camp, New York. That's in a very northern part of New York, and it snows up there. Didn't blow, just straight down, but a bunch of snow. And we did a lot of tunneling.
Hmm. In the snow?
Yes, had to. There would be snow drifts that would cover a barracks up to the first level. You couldn't look out a window or anything. I mean, it's solid snow. Hmm. And if your entrance was on the north, you couldn't get out the door without going out and digging holes. And you had to dig the holes out for the kitchen and all. And we did our training in the barracks. And we had what we called skyhooks. And these are big C-clamps type, screw in, and you'd lift cots up and hook them to the ceiling.
So they'd be out of the way for you to
and then
be able to use the
you'd space. Have your, you had a classroom, you drilled big enough to drill in, and so then we left there, and we were in winter gear, heavy overcoats and all of that, got on the train and went to Virginia, and by the time we got to Virginia, we'd shed all of our overcoats and all that heavy gear, and because it was, we'd been used to real cold weather, and we were burning up. But we were there, and from there we let on all the ship, went to North Africa, and we met Patton. We made it an amphibious landing. We'd course, practiced all of this and going up and down the ladders and getting in the boats. And so when we got there, while we unloaded, I didn't even give it a thought. And I really thought that we were making an amphibious landing in North Africa. We made an amphibious landing, but nobody was there but Patton. Going up and down the raising hell.
Was that in Libya, or what part of Africa would that have been? Morocco?
This was, oh gosh.
Tunisia? Egypt?
Oh gosh.
Sudan's
not there.
That's okay.
Man.
So had all the soldiers, I mean, you said there wasn't anybody there. Had they already brought them back?
The Germans had given up at this point. Tunisia. And he told us what was ahead. Talked to the officers and non-coms.
Were you under Patton then at that time?
We were under Patton. Patton was he was the Corps commander.
Did he think your discipline had improved at some point?
Not yet. it wasn't until we had landed in Sicily and had gone through the Sicilian campaign that he spoke to the troops, and with a little bit of beautiful profanity that he chose well, he did a great job with when he spoke. He told how proud he was and so on. And when you go to the armory, go to the museum down there, you'll read his speech that he gave, something to the effect that when the history is written, it will be written by the pen of the quill that was dipped in the blood of the Thunderbird. You've read that. Okay. So,
so no action really against the enemy in North Africa.
Nothing in North Africa.
And so you all.
We landed in Sicily, and Montgomery took the right flank and was going up the highway to Messina, and that was his objective. And Patton was to protect Montgomery's flank. And so we landed, Montgomery landed, goes this way. As we go in, and our landing was simple. I mean, there wasn't a shot fired. And after we pulled in, commander came in with his jeep, and he sent his executive officer. Told the executive officer you wanted him to make a recon of the area. And he said, well, I need someone to ride shotgun. I volunteer for everything. Heck, it doesn't make any difference what it is. I'll volunteer. But I saw that Jeep. That's a ride. And I immediately said, well, I can do that. So I got on the Jeep. We went out. Man, this is a whole new country. Gosh, it's different. Real neat. I'm looking around, finding you. Great. And the major is raising hell with me. I'm not paying attention. I am paying attention. I'm looking at everything. Well, we drive around and finally come back to where we started. And the commander put a map down on the hood of the Jeep and said, where did you go? And that major leaned over and looked at that map, and I'm thinking, that son of a bitch can't even read a map. So, old smart aleck me, I'm an Eagle Scout. Man, I know my map reading. So I said, well, sir, just hunkered up. I said, we start right here. We went right down here and here. Went right up here and down here and came back. And he said, what's right there? And I said, that's that hill that's over there. And he said, and I said, we went around that one. He said, can you guide the battalion to our objective? I said, sure. He said, report to E Company and take the point. Stupid. So I report to E Company. I've already been out here. Come on, gang, let's go. And they're, yep, slow down. There's nothing to slow down for. There's nothing out here. I've been here before. We got to our objective, stayed overnight, and next day, why, we started out for a armored car came down the highway or the road, and one of the guys took a rifle grenade, fired it, hit it right on the side, bounced off, didn't pull the pin. Of course, it took off, and the guy shot at it as it was pulling away. Then, right after noon, should be around 1, 2 o'clock, big explosion. And don't know until later on that there was a ammunition truck that was on its way into Comiso Airport, and they hit it with a rocket launcher. And, of course, the whole thing blew up, trees, everything around. So by the time we got there, I'm back at the unit with my runners, and the guys are stringing their wire. We get on the airport, and I got my my souvenir there, my everyone wanted a German swastika. Mm. And I got mine there and carried it all the way through, changing it from place to place until... And all of my... all of my platoon signed it.
Mm.
And I've got it. But anyway... But Patton, of course, you know, he didn't get along with Montgomery. Mm-hmm. And I think it was out of spite that he changed the course. Instead of protecting his flank, he headed for Palermo. That's the capital of Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
And we took Palermo, and had ice cream, and
that was high living that time, wasn't it?
And then we headed across. We had started having a lot of trouble. Our fighting was sparse. We'd run into a little bit of resistance, and shoot, our units were, they had their firing maneuver down to where it was an arch.
Hmm.
And
were they Germans that were retreating, or were they Italians, or both, or who were the enemy?
The Italians had already given up.
Hmm. So these were Germans then that were...
This is Germans. And then of course, by the time Montgomery got to Messina, about the same time that our troops got there. But we were late in that the Germans had taken everything they had and crossed the channel. Was
to leave Sicily behind, abandon Sicily.
Yeah. So then, of course, our next objective was to we'd been in battle. The 36th Division was given the task of taking Salerno, and we were in floating reserve, which meant that we wouldn't go until they'd established a beachhead, and that would take 2, maybe 3 days. So we were aboard ship, you know, just lounging around. And they put the call to the boats. And at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we were going down the ladder onto the boats. And we went in. And the Germans had this range of mountains, and they're looking down our throat.
And what beach was this, or what area was this landing? Because this was on the mainland of Italy.
This
wasn't Sicily. This was mainland of Italy.
This is mainland Italy. This is on the boot where the boot comes down and out.
Right.
Salerno is right in here.
Okay.
And
so you were getting there a lot earlier because you thought you'd be going in after the beachhead was
secured. Oh, yeah. But they, 36th Division, they really chopped them up. And Mark Clark, by this time, was the commander. And He took Patton's place. Of course, you know that story.
What happened to Patton? Was he relieved of duty because of Montgomery's?
No. His relieved because he slapped a soldier at an aid station. Patton went back to check the wounded, and he asked the kid what was wrong with him, and he was scared. And Patton took his gloves and slapped him across the face and said, "You're a coward." Said, "I don't put up with cowards in my outfit." Well, the thing is, you have newspaper men following generals around there to get a story, and here it was. High-ranking general slapping a poor, sick soldier. And so,
that wasn't the end of his career, though. Because didn't he still command in Germany?
Oh, later? Yeah, but see, they put...
was he a two-star at that point, or what was he?
What?
Was he a two-star at that point, or a three-star, or I wonder... Patton.
He was a two-star.
He was a two-star.
Yeah. And he... They set up a dummy army in England.
To fake, to try to trick the Germans?
Had trucks and guns and all kinds of stuff. All rubber balloons. They had did all kinds of fake stuff that, and any time that any airplane was in the air while they were out pushing these trucks around and give a, and here's this big army that they had, and it was nothing but these big balloons.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he's flaunching at the bits all the time, and we went the one thing that after we got ashore, Clark had already put out the word that a beachhead was untenable, and that he was getting ready to give the command to go back to the ships.
Wow.
And the 45th Division commander, our commander, said, "Just set the ammunition behind us because we're going to stay." Well, then Mark Clark had to tell Eisenhower that he had changed his mind and that we were going to stay in. But this was, for us, this was the toughest, or the first of the toughest battles that we had gotten into. In fact, the Germans had was forming to enter tanks, and they infantry was getting prepared and all, and from my position out there, and there is nothing between the line that I'm on and the Germans. And it's inevitable. With the firepower and with what they've got and all, they're nothing.
It's inevitable that what? That they're going to knock you guys off?
Oh, yeah. They're coming. Well, I guess you're talking about my religion. I've been to Sunday school. I knew about God and Jesus. But my prayer life was, as Patton would say, but I thought, you know, I guess, you know, this is not near as much fun as I thought it was going to be.
Did you think that was it? It was
going to happen? And I did some serious praying. Of course, since I know that I thought I was making a bargain. All the things that I'm going to do. But get me out of this one. Man, no more than I said, get me out of here. Two planes I've never seen in my life was P-38s, and there was two of them. And those P-38s came right over us and started their strafing runs, peeling back and going up and down. They tore up the German line. Thank you, God. I've been trying my best to keep my promises. I'm here because of the planes he sent me. Of course, I know everyone was praying, but those were my planes. But we moved out of there, of course. Then, of course, all the battles. The Rapido and the rivers that we had to cross and all of the things that Monte Cassino, that was a place that we couldn't get around. Thousands of lives were lost there. Mm-hmm. And so they took us. They took our division, the 3rd Division.
Were you headed to Rome at this point? Was that your objective?
Our objective was Rome. So we pulled out and made an amphibious landing at Anzio. And you know the story of Anzio. we had a commander that Clark had put in command of the landing, and one of my jobs was to find the command post.
The enemy command post?
What?
The enemy command post?
No.
Establish your command post.
Establish our command post.
Right.
because you had to have a center. Every time you made your move, you didn't move out of here until you had established another command post. Had the wire in, had the messengers there, and all. And so the signal officer has the responsibility for establishing, and we spent a lot of time learning what a good command post was, getting in, getting out, lines of communication, how can you command your troops from a spot that you pick. You can't get out in a hole, you can't, so many things that you can't do, so you've got to be looking for a good place. And shoot, had my Jeep, and we were checking out the area, and we got to a highway and called back and told them that, of course, we're using our code words all the time, telling them where we're located. And they said, "You can't be there." I said, "Well, yes, here's the highway and so on." And they said, "What point are you at?" And we told them what point we were from the codes on the map. And they said, "Well, I want you to shoot the azimuth to these locations." So they gave me three points.
To triangulate.
And they said, "You're too far out. You get back." Said, "You're outside of the beachhead." And said, "It's not even secure, and you're out there."
Now, so, how many people were with you when you were out doing this?
At that time, there was five of us
in your unit.
Yeah. Or my section. So
that were out in this area beyond the beachhead.
Yeah.
Were you the leader as the?
Just my platoon. Looking for a place for.
Right. So they said, "Come on back."
So we went back.
Were you on foot, or did you have a vehicle?
I had a vehicle. We went back. And we didn't go all the way back in to the headquarters, because we found a good location with a devil aid and some ditches that would be ideal if, you know, beginning to get late. And so we stayed all night. And that night they blew up my my trailer and had all of our gear, our spare batteries, the wire and stuff that we needed to carry with us. And
was that the trailer that was with you, or the one that was back at the
This camp? Is trailer that was with me.
So you were taking mortar fire during the night, or how did it get blown up?
One round came in and got my trailer. Nothing else.
A lucky shot.
Well,
I mean, they knew you were there. I mean, your
I don't know. But that happened.
So you can't really operate without that trailer. As far as laying line and all that stuff.
Well, I'm not the only one that has a vehicle in it.
Okay.
The wire section, they have nothing but wire. My wire is used once we get inside to go from the switchboards to the different telephones.
Oh, okay.
But anyways, then after the next morning, we went back. I had to find another trailer to steal. We managed. So that we could have, guys, you know, you're on a beach, and what's there? If you put in a request or tell them you need some, well, the chances of getting it is from slight to none, you know. So if you want something, and, you know, vehicle same way. If you want a vehicle, if you were quick and smart enough, you could steal one. But eventually we got out. We were attacked. 157th had a lot of people captured on one of their outings, and we were sitting on the high ground watching it happen. And
were they captured and killed, or were they taken off somewhere?
No. They were. If you give up, they just trot you off. When I went back for the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Rome, one of the guys that was captured, he and I went back to Anzio, and went back to where the cave that he was in, he needed to get some pictures for a book that he had written, It's kind of amusing. They gave us a sedan and a driver to drive back, so the cave wasn't there. The cave was a clay cave. And they mined clay like you mine coal. And had these big, in 50 years, they're doing what they're doing every place else, and that is just take the top off and then just start scooping the clay up.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no
cave left.
No cave left. And we took some pictures, and then I went back to the place where I was caught out repairing a line. All the wiremen were gone, and there was no runners around, and I was the only one, and so I grabbed the line, and that's the way you check it. You just grab it and start walking with it running through your hand, and When I found the brake, I started repairing it, and while I'm repairing it, there's an underpass, and I thought I saw something on the other side of the underpass, and so I finished quick with my splice, and sure enough, there's a tank there. So I lay down, put the clips on the wire, and called back. Told them I'm testing the wire, and they said that let us ring. And I said, let me take the clip off before you do. And so evidently they rung. I waited a while, clipped it back, and they said it's good. I said, well, I've got some bad news for you. I said, there's tanks on the other side of the railroad tracks. I said, I see them through the overpass. And they said, which one? Well, it just so happened. There's three underpasses over the railroad. And they wanted to know which one, and I told them. And they said, you stay there and tell us what. So I directed the fire until they had pulled, got their tanks out of there, and a lot of action was happening. And I'm sitting out there hiding like a coward, and when it's all over with, why? If you read a citation on my Silver Star, it says that I stayed with my radio. I didn't have a radio. I had a telephone that I was into what? But we going to Rome was when we got out. That was another walk in the park.
It was basically at that point it had been cleared, the way it had been cleared when you got there?
Well, yeah, the Germans had all pulled by this time.
How were you received by the people of Rome?
Oh, big goods.
Did you feel like a welcoming or a hero?
Yes. We pulled outside of Rome, set up a camp, and cleaned our gear and all, and they came around and told us that the next day that any of the Catholics that wanted to go in to Rome and have an audience with the Pope, there would be transportation. So the next morning, the guys loaded on the truck and went to the Vatican, and I told Whitey that You know, we ought to go in. We ought to find out what's going on. Nothing happening around here. I said, we'll just go in and see St. Peter's and the Vatican. So we drove in, and Whitey put it, turned his wheels and put a chain on the steering gear, steering wheel, and chained it. took the distributor off and.
These are the things to make sure your Jeep didn't get stolen.
That's the thing.
Wow.
And you do things that. If you just take the distributor out, they'll still take and push it. But if you turn your wheels, you know, by this time,
figured out.
So we went, we went in, and right after we got there, whether there was a an American priest that was greeted us and wanted to know where we were from and all, and he was part of the church there and wanted to know if he could show us around. Well, yeah, you know, great. So we walked through looking at everything in St. Peter's, and he's pointing out what this is and what that is and this painting is and so on. And he said, would you like to see the statues on the roof? Statues on the roof? Never heard of that. Yeah. So, we went up on the roof. When you look at St. Peter's, here's all of these statues. They're big. They're well done. And they're all up there. And I'm amazed at what all. Well, he said, you know, said, if we're going to hear the Pope, said, we've got to go. Okay. So we followed him and took us up. And he opened the door. And when he opened the door, here are all these soldiers in there sitting on the floor. Okay. So we go in. Just a little bit later, the Pope comes in. And tells the soldier how proud they are that they're there. They appreciate what they've done. And all. And bless the group and told us that as you leave, that I have a gift for you. And so, of course, by this time, everyone's standing. No one's sitting down. They all just standing there. And the guards come in. Well, they're already there, but more come in. They
surround it.
Usher Pope Pius. And so when we left, we got a rosary that was blessed by the Pope, and and his picture. Interesting. Which is on my wall upstairs. When I got back, I told Mary Snyder, who lived right behind us, very devout Catholics. Back then, there was only about a half a dozen Catholic families in Edmond.
Wow.
And so, of course, Mary came over to see us, and I told her I had something that she might appreciate. So I showed her my rosary, and I said, this is the one that the Pope blessed. Man, I thought she was going to go in. And could she hold it?
Yeah, here.
Well, I had two families that invited me to their home to tell about meeting the Pope. And
that probably was one of the highlights, positive highlights, I would guess, of your time in Europe. Would you say that?
No. But anyway, I gave the rosary to Mary and told her that she might like to have it.
Right.
And just before she died, she sent it back to me. So I have it. And from all the ones that that I saw or have seen, it's not very spectacular.
Yeah.
Kind of. But from a Catholic standpoint, the Pope blessed that. So, but then we pulled out of there, and we went to southern France, made the invasion at southern France.
Okay.
And
was it simultaneous with Normandy and stuff?
No.
Or it was before that.
They landed in France the day that Rome fell.
D-Day was when Rome fell.
Right.
Oh, okay.
And when people talk about the fight in, or the war in Europe,
right,
they think of D-Day.
Yeah, they don't think about Italy and all the...
We've been fighting for a year.
That's right, yeah.
And where we landed, there was a big gun emplacement with nobody around it.
They had left that.
And they had left. And by this time, gosh, I don't know how much time had passed, but they were beginning to move. And then we fell in line and started Nuremberg, on the ice roller those towns. Anyway.
Did you drive all, I mean, you landed in southern France and then started to make for Germany? I mean, was that?
Yes. And.
How far did you all get? Did you go to Germany?
Yes. Our final objective was, Nuremberg.
Huh.
And see, that death camp.
I was going to ask if there were any death camps.
Death camp. The cow was just out of Nuremberg.
Did you go to Dachau?
Yes.
Really?
And the people there. I said Nuremberg. Munich. We were in Munich.
Okay.
That's our final destination. That's where we wound up.
Okay.
And Nuremberg is one of the places. But the people of Munich, we told them about the
Dachau.
There's not such a place out there. They loaded them up and took them out. When I went out, we didn't get in. Nobody got in. The 157th had liberated it. But by the time they got the people, man, it was completely closed off. The medics and all that was coming in, they didn't release them. They got German citizens in to start cleaning it up. Burying when the division took it, they were still burning bodies. Dead bodies stacked. And we could see through the wire. And we walked around, but like I say, they wasn't letting anybody in. It didn't make any difference. What?
Did we know about the existence of death camps? Did the Army know that you would be encountering that when you went into Germany? Or was that a surprise?
They knew it, but they didn't know at what extent. I'm sure that I didn't know anything about them.
Mm. What were you first told, or what do you remember about when you learned what was going on?
What?
How did you hear about it, or what did you? What was said?
Right after we moved in, we were told while we were moving. By this time, Pat was back in the fight.
And was he back with your unit? Or
No.
He never came back to your
unit? No. Of course, he never was part of the unit.
Well.
We were part of his army.
That's right.
But he now had the, didn't he have a third army?
Uh-huh, I
think so. I think that's it. Okay. And he was, man, running amok. I mean, he was running out of gas. And everyone was talking about they can't keep gas with Patton. And, of course, you know, they talk about Patton liberated the bulge? Mm-hmm. That's not exactly right. But Patton did. They were trying to figure out what they were going to do. And Eisenhower had his big meeting. And they were talking about the relief of the bulge. And Patton said that they're talking how many days it was going to take to break someone loose. And he said he could make it in 3 days. And everyone was making fun of the fact that there was no way that he could do it. Well, he had already told his troops, and this is this hearsay. Mm-hmm. The people that should know say that he had already told his troops, get ready and start moving because we're going to go. We're the ones. And then he, in the meeting, he said, I can do it. Well, the only thing is, one of the biggest difficulties they had, they couldn't get any supplies, they couldn't get anything because of the overcast. Mm-hmm. The planes weren't flying. They
couldn't land and supply.
But the sun came out the day before Patton got there. And just as soon as the sun came out, the planes began to fly and drop supplies and also did some strafing and so on. But Patton still gets the credit for being part of the liberation of the regular army, they're a close knit group. These damn civilian soldiers like the 45th and all. The 10th Army, I mean, the 10th Division, the Mountain Division, they call them, their objective was to take DeKalb. They were the liberators. Mm-hmm. The colonel had already taken it, and when the general came and told him that that was his objective and that they would take charge, he ran him off. And of course I think that that's part of the story at the museum. Mm-hmm. Is that commander telling about his taking of. Mm-hmm. And have you seen that room by any chance?
I've been in the museum, but I don't remember that
part. There is a room. There is a room. And that's all that's in it. Is the photographs and all. Unless when they redid the museum.
Are you talking about downtown, the museum? Or our armory here?
No, the big.
No, I haven't. I need to go there. Can you believe that? I'm sorry.
You have not been to the 45th Division Museum.
No, I have not.
My gosh.
We're going to remedy that.
The well, one of the things that you'll see is a huge picture, a blow-up of a picture of a soldier lying in Hitler's bed. Reading a copy of Blind Call. That's my brother.
Oh, really?
Wow. And that's in the museum down there.
Wow.
So
did both of your brothers that were in the division survive the war?
My older brother and I stayed with him. ML, the
middle brother.
Middle brother from Art, between me. they pulled him out. He was a steam fitter. And he went to work building steamships. So he spent all of his time building ships until
stateside.
Until it was over with.
Did your older brother make it through the war?
Yeah. And then my little brother, he joined us in Germany.
Joined the unit?
Yep.
Wow. And did he make it as well?
Yeah.
Wow.
And just as soon as he got out of high school, he joined the Army. And they sent him over as a replacement. And we had trying to think where we were when he joined us. But anyway, my brother found out that, or my mother had written and said he had gone to Germany. So he was the mess sergeant for regimental headquarters. So he knew everybody, had all kinds of contacts, so he got to check and work if they had any idea where little brother is, and found out that he was in the replacement center not too far away. So he got in the Jeep and went to visit him, and found out where he was and all, and told him, said, want you in the unit, said, I'll go make the arrangements. So he went back and told the commander that he wanted a little brother, and they said, fine. Said, we'll start paperwork. And said, about getting him. And hi. Let me call you back. then he went back the next day and to tell him that they were working on paperwork to get him. And my little brother said, well, we're moving out this afternoon. He said, what's your job? And he says, I'm VA Army.
What does that mean?
Running automatics. That's the automatic rifle.
He's a maintenance guy for those rifles then?
Oh, no.
He was an infantryman, wasn't
he? He was an infantryman. VR men don't last very long because of the amount of ammunition that they're firing. They get spotted and fired on. It's, you know, one of those things. But anyway, and when he told him, he said, I'm a VAR man. He said, no, you're not. Get your bag and get in the Jeep. So he took him back. He was actually AWL. But they picked him up, and he became the assistant supply sergeant.
Wow.
And worked in the supply room.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, very short time, we're out of the war. Mm-hmm. Because we've... we're in Munich. The Russians had already made contact. In a short time, the war's over.
Mm-hmm.
And just before the war's over, I was called into Colonel Cotton Smith's, who was battalion commander. He called, there was six of us, six sergeants, that was called up battalion headquarters, and got there, and here these five other sergeants are, and started asking, what do you do? You know, why would the colonel be calling us up here?
Yeah.
And we'd been into trouble. Not caught, but we'd been doing things we shouldn't have, you know. But finally, he came through, and his office is one of the big houses, or the big buildings, just off of King's Plaza.
Uh-huh.
And they're two of the landmark Nazi buildings.
Hmm.
And beautiful terrazzo floors, winding staircase going up to the second floor and all. And so we're waiting, and he comes in, passes right by us, and of course we're all saluted, and he threw off one of his salutes and just kept going, and we all knew we were in trouble. And
what had you been doing?
Well, I don't know. we'd taken some of the money that we'd gotten from some of the banks that going through, you know, and we had sorted out and found out what was good and what people were taking, and going to the farms and buying things, you know, but. Anyway, finally the sergeant major came out and said, Colonel, see you now. We walked in, stood in front of his desk, and he sat there and stared at it for a while, and if everyone was like me, I was really scared that there must be something that he found out about that I don't know what could have happened. You know, it just... So finally he got up from his desk, came around and started down the line and said, well, I want to be first to congratulate you, second damn lieutenants. Whew! Great, you know. So he dismissed us, and
so you were a commission then? I mean, that was
I was at that point. You're a second damn lieutenant. Okay. So we get outside and we start talking to one another. You know, what's this mean? I already know that if you're ever promoted, that you can't be in the unit when you're promoted, you have to go to another unit.
Oh.
And I don't know what this means on the point system.
Mm.
I've got enough points to go home. I've been here for forever.
Mm.
So I get on the telephone and I call my brother. I told him what happened. And he cussed a little bit and said, you're not going to be an officer. And I said, well, I don't know. And he said, well, just a bit. So I wait around and he called me back and he said, little brother, how long will it take you to get your duffel bag? And I said, why? And he said, you and I are going home. So I got my duffel bag, got my driver, and he took me over to headquarters. And when I got to headquarters, why, they're real happy to see me. Said, Lieutenant, you've got an oath of office to sign. And I said, well, I'm on my way home. And they say, well, you've got an office. You've got an oath to sign. And I said, I'm not going to sign it. So we go to division headquarters. And when we get to division headquarters, why, troops from different places are coming together, and we get to the point that we're going home. And they call me in and said, looking over your records, and there is an oath here that has not been signed. And I said, I'm not signing that oath. I said, okay. And put it in the packet. Next morning, we take a plane to North Africa. And when we get to North Africa, we board a B-17. And there's three B-17s flying back with troops in. And flew into Florida and took a train from Florida to Arkansas. Mm. And in Florida, they pointed out I had not signed my oath of office. I get to Arkansas, Camp Grover, and start through the processing. And same thing. Said, and he kept calling me Lieutenant. You haven't signed your oath. I said, I'm not going to.
And you're still wearing your sergeant?
Well, sure.
Yeah, I'm insignia. You're a sergeant.
So they discharged me, and I come home. I'm discharged. I get back in June. Have to make up my mind what I'm going to do. Am I going to GED and go to college, or am I going to finish up my high school? And I thought, well, I've lost a lot. I just go back to school. So I went up to high school and asked them what I had to do to get my degree. And they said, well, you got to enroll. So I enrolled, went to high school, and was a senior in high school. The class elected me as president of the class. I couldn't play football, so I told them that I like to assist the coach, and they told me that they were sure that Bobby Van Antwerp would love to have me as assistant coach. But before school started, I got a telephone call that Bobby is not back. We need you to go issue out the uniforms to the team. Said, okay, Raider, we'll meet you at the gym. So I went up to the gym. And the boys were there, and they were already picking out their uniforms, the one they had last year, and the new one was picking up what was left. They were in terrible shape. Superintendent met me and said, this is what Bob would like for you to work on. Here are five plays, a pass pattern, and a punt formation that we want you to work on with the boys. I said, okay. I said, I don't know anything about T formation, but I can sure get them in shape. And we went to work, and shoot, I'm an Army sergeant that dealt with men, and I can order around, and I can take these kids and whip them in shape, which I did. I tried to play defense, and in the Army on the team, the only thing I could do was make the basketball team. I was one of the basketball players. And I had my jacket that was stolen from me, and it eventually came back to me. But anyway, so I'm working on the kids, and we play our first game, and I'm the coach. No Bob. We played Guthrie, and I gave the ball game away. One of the kids got hurt, and I ran out on the field. The referee caught me before I got there, stuck his finger in my face, and says, coach, you know better than to be out on this field. 1 yard for every step it takes you to get back on that damn base. I took big steps, and I got over it and watched as they got the kid up, got him to the sideline and all. Back then, the coach was not allowed to be on the field. If he sent a play in, that player that was substituted could not be in the huddle until the next play. All kinds of crazy things happened on the field. We had hideouts. We had the water boy play. We had all of this stuff that is crazy, but you couldn't be on the field. You taught, you had a skull session on a Thursday night and told the players everything that they were going to do the next day. And the quarterback ran the team.
Wow.
Now then, everybody from the lowest kid to the professionals. They do exactly what the coach tells them to do. Back then, it was a game that the kids played. Well, Guthrie scored. 6-0 ball game. Mm. Next week, we work real hard and go to Kingfisher. We play Kingfisher. 0-0 tie. I had a good defense. Proud of. But after that game, the next Monday, I was in the superintendent's office to tell him that I had to get somebody else because evidently I wasn't doing anything right because I didn't know what else to do with that T formation except those plays, and those plays weren't working. And I was there before he got there, and when he came in, as he was going to his office, he saw me and said, "Ornette, I'm glad to see you. Need to talk to you." And so I went in to tell him that he's going to have to get somebody else. And before I had a chance to tell him anything, he said, school board had a meeting Saturday after your game. Said they like the way you handle the boys. Said they want you to be the head football coach at the Edmond High School football team. And I said, I can do anything I want. Said it's your ball club. I spent time with E.C. Hafer at Kirkland Drug Store drawing plays on napkins. Getting working the single wing that I knew something about. We played Foster High School 56-0. came back and gone to class, real proud of what happened.
And you're attending class at this point.
Oh, I'm a senior in high school. I'm sitting in the classrooms with the kids that are on my football team.
Yeah.
So, I I'm called out of class. Superintendent wants to see you. So I went over. I'm all excited, you know. Won a ball game. Went in and thinking, boy howdy, going to get patted on the back. He said, Ornette, we don't beat teams like that. And I said, everybody played. He said, we don't beat teams like that. And I said, Sipes played almost half the game. That's my backup quarterback. I don't know if he's a sophomore or freshman that year, but anyway, he reminded me three times that we just don't beat teams like that. And I told the kids we're having fun. He said, I'm sure they were. So, let's see.
What'd you tell the team then?
What?
What'd you tell the team then? What were they supposed to do in that situation?
I didn't say a thing to the team.
Huh.
Because oh gosh, what is the name of that school? Broomcorn Center, down by Falls Valley. Anyway, we played them, and that's the one where we kicked the ball back to them on the kickoff. Because Hafer said that if you get the ball and you don't run with it, you can kick it and kick it right back to them and put them on the defense. And that's what I had. I was a defensive team. Right. No one was scoring on me yet.
Right.
So we played the first half, and when we, at the halftime, I told them.
Purcell? Was it Purcell?
That, what?
Purcell? Is that what it was? Not Paul's Valley.
No. But anyway, and we.
So you kicked the ball back at him so that you could be on defense?
Yeah. So I told him, I said, it doesn't make any difference who gets the ball. Don't run with it. Just take and kick it. Well, I had one of the best punters in the
high school ball.
Playing in the conference. And I was in hopes that he'd get the ball. But who gets the ball but Lowell Thompson, the quarterback, and he couldn't kick a ball. And I screwed up. Well, he kicked. It didn't make any difference, because when he kicked the ball, everybody on the opposing team stopped. And what's that ball? And, of course, we're charging down. And they put him in a hole. And we had people talking about that for a long time. But it was things like that that we did. But we beat them. And our next team was Midwest City. And they were going to be the conference champions. They had a passer. And he was good. And so, of course, we already knew about this because everyone was talking about how good they were and how good this passer is. And I'm having all kinds of trouble with names. Sheldon. Sheldon was one of my tackles, and he was good. And he said, Coach said that Coker will not complete a pass.
That was a quarterback for Midwest City?
That was a quarterback, Midwest City. And the kids had worked on something that I didn't know about. But the guard did not take care of his man. And he didn't let him The only thing he was interested in was taking the man in front of Sheldon and jerking him, which gave Sheldon enough opening that he was wide open going in after that quarterback. Mm-hmm. And he ate his lunch. Mm-hmm. I tell you, they didn't score on us. We scored on them.
Wow.
We didn't lose another ball game until we played Putnam City in the final ball game.
Mm. For the championship?
What?
Was it for the championship or was that
the
conference game?
Right. It was conference. They didn't have state champions.
Mm.
You won your conference. That's the big deal.
Okay.
And so I had a winning season.
What an amazing year that was. And then you graduated after that year?
I graduated, went to Central. While I was at Central, I organized the first junior high basketball team. Because they only had one gym, Jefferson Hall.
Maybe our guy.
Jefferson Hall is named after my grandmother's brother. And you'll see that on. But that's the only gym besides the college.
Okay.
So when I proposed that we start a basketball program for the junior high, they said, "Where are you going to practice?" And I said, "Well, I like to use the gym." And said, "Well, it's only available first thing in the morning." And I said, "Okay, we'll practice in the morning before school." And they said, "You're not going to get any kids up here to practice." I said, "I think we will." I organized a basketball team. Did real well our first year. In our second year, we won the county tournament.
And this isn't you, is it?
What?
That's not you.
That's me.
This is you on the right?
That's me.
Wow.
And you saw me in my uniform, my football uniform.
That's the invitation I did, yeah.
Okay.
Is that your senior year?
That's my senior year.
That's your senior year. Okay.
And this is 2 years later.
Okay. And so you all, did you say you won the championship the second year?
Yes.
Wow.
The county tournament was the ultimate.
Wait, and so this would have been what, 47? 48? When did you come back from the war?
That's 40.
45. No.
That picture was 48.
48.
When those boys got into high school, they had the intramural tournament where the seniors play the sophomores and the juniors play the freshmen, and that makes the juniors and the seniors in the playoff.
Right.
Didn't work. When the juniors played the freshmen,
freshmen beat them. I put them in the tournament with seniors. And they beat the seniors.
Wow.
Steve Shepherd.
Did you know Steve? He's a member of the church. Steve was the basketball coach. He told
people that I sent him the best basketball team that he ever worked with. Right, and he got me a job as a coach, which I didn't take later on. You might want to turn that off while I go back.
Oh, okay.